This is Eleanor Lacaine. On Election Day, November 3rd, voters will decide the fate of the nation. Will we have another 4 years of chaos, division, and trauma with Trump? Or will Joe Biden be elected to heal our wounds and get America moving forward again? Our first guest, Harold Meyerson, will join us for election analysis. Following him will be a conversation with Chuck Collins on wealth inequality. Harold Meyerson is one of the nation's leading political analysts. He's editor at large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. He has also been a weekly op-ed columnist for the Washington Post and executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. He's here with us today to share his analysis of the 2020 election. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
It's always good to be here, Eleanor.
That's great. I appreciate your brilliant analysis and humor, which we've needed a lot of the past 3 years. So I want to start off by looking, the election is just 89 days away. How do we beat Trump?
Well, right now, every poll shows that Joe Biden is beating Trump. That's the result of pretty much universal opposition to Trump by Democrats. And it is the result of the vast majority of the Democrats who supported Bernie Sanders also deciding that they're going to vote for Joe Biden. And it is the result of a weakening in some key constituencies that supported Trump in 2016. Notably, seniors, voters over 65, who have been are particularly endangered by COVID-19, by the pandemic. And I think that's one reason why Biden has opened a wide lead in Florida, which is the retirement mecca for seniors living east of the Mississippi. And it's, as well, he's not doing nearly as well among white working class women who supported Trump substantially over Hillary Clinton in 2016, but have been alienated by Trump's, just endemic callousness and lack of empathy. So those are two really key constituencies where he is much weaker than he was in 2016. Now, that said, Trump is doing his damnedest to create sort of a dysfunctional election, appropriately enough for a dysfunctional president. He has pretty much ordered the post office to slow down at a time when voter registration and voting by mail will be crucial to the election. And he clearly just wants to call into question the results of the election, which is one reason why the victory by Biden, and I suspect the Democratic takeover of the Senate as well as holding the House, needs to be by a fairly large margin, so that the networks and others going by their exit polling will call the election earlier than all the votes having been counted, since, as we now know, counting ballots by mail can take a very long time.
Right. And in that time, if it comes down to who's voting by mail, there could be a lot of mischief.
Yes. Yes. Well, again, the politicization of the by putting a Trump person atop the Postal Service is, I think, one of the most crucial problems. And congressional Democrats have been calling attention to this now, particularly just in the last few days, as mail delivery across the board slows.
Right, exactly. So where do you see the key battleground states for Biden? And I would imagine some of those overlap with some of the states the Democrats need to win to try and get back the majority in the Senate.
That's true. Well, you begin with the mistakenly called blue wall states of the industrial or post-industrial Midwest. You begin with Pennsylvania, with Michigan, and with Wisconsin. Now, polling has shown that Michigan is at this juncture heavily inclined to favor Joe Biden. Hillary Clinton didn't really invest in a voter turnout operation in some of the cities of those states that Democrats need to get a high turnout in to win. Certainly not Detroit, certainly not Milwaukee, and not even Philadelphia. That's a mistake which is not being repeated this time around. So that's a beginning. Secondly, the Republicans before we leave the industrial Midwest, it's also really significant to know that Biden has now in recent polls taken the lead in Ohio, which is a state Democrats had pretty much written off. Ohio, of all the major states in the United States, has the highest percentage of white working class residents and white working class voters, presumably Trump's base. But as Sherrod Brown, the progressive Democrat who keeps being elected and reelected to the US Senate from Ohio, has demonstrated, there are ways that Democrats still can win Ohio. And Joe Biden seems at the moment to be doing that, I think largely due to the defection of white working class women from Trump's standard. There was a story just came out yesterday that Biden is doing a massive media buy in 15 states. That reflects, I think, both the caution and the optimism of the Biden campaign, that states that Democrats might have written off just 6 months ago, like Ohio, are actually now very much in play. I've already mentioned Florida, but the fact is that, the Republicans since Ronald Reagan have had basically a Sun Belt coalition, that their base has been based in the Sun Belt, where, white racism was strongest, and unionization, the one way that the white working class voters can come into contact with progressive information, unionization was weakest. The Sun Belt is beginning to crack. Arizona, which also has a key Senate race with Mark Kelly, former astronaut, running against Republican Kristen Sinema. Arizona is a state that now looks like it could well be in the Democratic column, both for the Senate and for the presidency. And like most of the Sun Belt, a lot of that is simply due to demographic transformation, the increasing share of the state that is Latino, the increasing share of the electorate that is Latino, and the fact that its cities, like all cities, are home to liberal whites. Phoenix has had a Democratic mayor now for a long time and has been opposed to most of the Republican state government actions, particularly on immigration. Mm-hmm. So that's also the possibility of a transformation down the line in Texas. Texas is sort of in play this year, and that's kind of remarkable, because if Texas is in play, that's like the Republicans putting California in play. I mean, this is the ultimate anchor of the Republican Electoral College base. But the second anchor is Florida, and that severely weakens them. Then again, demographic transformation in Georgia has certainly put Georgia in play, and to a certain degree, North Carolina. And again, as well, the coming of white millennials to the major cities in those states, to Atlanta, to Charlotte, puts those states into play. Now, I think some people looking at the sort of mega politics thought, well, maybe the Republicans are going to get weaker in the Sun Belt, but maybe the Republicans, due to high white working class populations, can establish a base in the industrial Midwest. But this year, they can't establish that base in the industrial Midwest, and more of the Sun Belt is in play. Now, if you look at states where the Democrats also have possibilities of Senate takeovers, I've mentioned Arizona. The closest parallel to Arizona would be Colorado, where a unpopular Republican senator, Cory Gardner, is not favored to hold his seat. The Democrats are running John Hickenlooper, who was both the mayor of Denver and then the governor of the state. And Hickenlooper stands a good chance of winning. And again, in Colorado, there's been a lot of the two developments that I've been talking about, Latino in migration and the flocking of white liberal millennials to Denver in particular, also Boulder. That's the kind of thing that can change a state. And then if you look at the map, the whole Southwest, you know, including the Pacific Coast, with the exception of heavily Mormon Utah, looks like it's going to become, I think, reliably Democratic in future elections, and I think quite possibly in this election as well. That's a major change. That was a major element of the Republican Sun Belt strategy. Other states, I already mentioned North Carolina, where the Republican senator is Tom Tillis is being opposed by Democrat Cal Cunningham, and Cunningham has a clear lead in North Carolina. So North Carolina is a key swing state, both at the presidential and senatorial level. And then we go up to our northeast corner, Maine, where Susan Collins has been walking a tightrope for much of her career as a self-advertised moderate Republican. But moderate Republican is something of an oxymoron, or becoming more of one with each passing day. And her votes for both of Trump's Supreme Court nominees really sort of stand against her commitment to being pro-choice, of putting these solidly anti-choice judges onto the Supreme Court. And so she's very embattled, and Speaker of the Maine State Assembly, whose name eludes me at the moment, but
Sarah Gideon,
that's right. Yes, thank you. Is the Democratic nominee there, and also has a lead, though not a large lead, over Collins. So Maine, I think, is pretty much in the Democratic column on the presidential line, and it's certainly a state where the Democrats hope to pick up a seat in the Senate. Now that would be that would be four seats, which would be enough to give them a majority, even if Doug Jones loses in Alabama, which is not a given. Doug Jones was kind of a fluke election over Roy Moore, a candidate who clearly liked to spend some intimate time with girls, not women, girls. Because otherwise Alabama would almost never have elected a Democrat. Still, Doug Moore has some real cred there. He's being opposed by the former football coach at Auburn, Tommy Tuberville, which sounds like a name out of a little kid's book. You know, he has a shot. But even if he loses, the Democrats would still have 50 votes. And if Biden is elected, whoever his vice president is, which is an interesting topic in and of itself, would be able to cast a tie-breaking vote. But Democrats are also in the running in some other states. In Iowa is one, and even Mitch McConnell in Kentucky is under the gun and is in a particular conundrum right now, given his opposition to extending unemployment insurance in a state that has lots and lots of poor people who more or less are accustomed to voting for for Republicans, but you know, have been known to deviate from that. Amy McGrath is his opponent there, the Democrat, a former Air Force fighter pilot. So there are a bunch of Republican Senate seats that are still up for grabs. And we should also go to Montana and note that the popular Democratic governor, Steve Bullock, is challenging the Republican incumbent, Mr. Daines, and is that's a race that's polling pretty close as well. So there are a number of possible Democratic Senate pickups, and I think probably enough for them to take the Senate. And I think clearly they're going to pick up some House seats too. This may turn out to be a wave election in the best of all possible Democratic worlds. And in a wave election, there will be some surprising Democratic victories too. So we'll just have to see.
Right, and I'm hoping we can put Senator Lindsey Graham in that wave and be carried out of office. I don't know if you have any chance to beat Lindsey Graham in South Carolina.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. The polling has been surprisingly okay for his Democratic challenger, whose name also eludes me, but you have it right in front of you, don't you?
No.
Jamie Harrison.
Yeah, very good.
Jamie Harrison. Yeah. Okay. Give me a senior moment and a half here. That would be a surprising result, since South Carolina is certainly a bedrock right-wing state. But Trump's weakening, and the fact that Lindsey Graham has been very volubly all over the map in support of Trump, and then now and then, you know, a burst of opposition, and then going back to support, that act may be past its prime in the minds of many South Carolinians. So we shall see. But there, and that too reflects, as does Georgia, as does Florida, as do Texas and Arizona, and North Carolina, the growing peril to the Republican Sunbelt base.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of hot elections there, a lot of good possibilities for Democrats. Just want to ask you briefly about women. I know the last time you were on the show, we were talking about the great gains women made in running and winning in 2018. Is that continuing this year? Do we have a lot of good women candidates, or was that a one and done?
Well, there are a lot of good women candidates. Sarah Gideon in Maine and in Iowa, the Democrats have a strong woman candidate running against Joni Ernst, another first-term Republican senator whose polling does not show her with anything like a major lead. I think that race was within 1% in the most recent poll, a Monmouth poll that I have seen out of Iowa. Of course, there are interesting Democratic women winning Democratic primaries. Just Tuesday, the surprise victory of Cori Bush in St. Louis, ousting Lacey Clay, who, despite the word Lacey, was male, is evidence of that. And then, of course, as I alluded to a moment ago, we have the whole vice presidential contest in which at this juncture the three front runners are all African American women, plus which in one of the races, Cori Bush is not the only progressive woman Democrat to have ousted a Democratic incumbent. Also, what was her name? Newman in Chicago ousted Dan Lipinski in a primary earlier this year. So I think there is a cohort of younger progressive women and younger progressive African Americans who are some of whom will be enlarging the squad, the AOC Gang of Four, in the next Congress.
All right, it's encouraging to see some of the fresh voices coming along. Let's talk about the vice presidential race. I know you wrote a great piece yesterday talking about Karen Bass, who's ahead of the Congressional Black Caucus and longstanding progressive activist and leader in California, that a lot of progressives are hoping that Biden will pick her as kind of a progressive balance on the ticket. What do you see happening? Do you favor Karen Bass, and who do you think Biden will select?
Well, there are two progressives really in the hunt. Karen Bass is one and Elizabeth Warren is the other. Elizabeth Warren, of course, is not African-American. At this juncture, that may be an obstacle. Bass and Warren have strong points in being able to help Biden, with getting progressives either more involved in the campaign or actually willing to vote for him if they weren't otherwise. Karen in particular, I think, who is not well known nationally, but I think would be able to bring out sort of a younger blacks otherwise resistant perhaps to voting for Biden. They each have downsides electorally. Clearly they provide Republicans with a line of attack, however spurious or semi-real that line of attack may be, because of their clearly liberal politics. Susan Rice, the former National Security Advisor under President Obama, and Kamala Harris, Senator from California, are the other two possibilities still very much in the hunt. Rice is a bit of a conundrum. At a time when domestic issues, racial and economic justice, dominate the political sensibility of the Democratic Party and the political discussion in the whole nation, that's really not where she's been and not where she has a record. She's a foreign policy maven was close to Biden and has a lot of people who worked with her in the Obama administration backing her. The Republicans will no doubt think she said about their trumped up issue.
Talking about who the vice presidential candidate might be that Biden would select. So just to carry on in some of the discussion we're having, some of the other issues to consider in this election is what the average citizen can do to impact this election. And we'll be talking about that more next week. But I think sometimes people have the misconception that the candidate and the campaign staff are the only ones who really get the real work done, and the volunteers are kind of flotsam and jetsam. That could not be further from the truth. Citizens being engaged is probably the single most influential factor here. So you were talking about the vice presidential candidates, and I agree with you. I think it's very odd that Susan Rice has risen to the top of the pack in consideration, given that her only calling card is foreign policy expertise, and domestic issues are so important right now, and Biden himself has foreign policy credentials and doesn't really need that in a running mate. So, I know they have a personal connection and have worked together when Susan Rice was in the Obama administration, but it's just still seems to me kind of an odd choice. And she's not really known in the country. I don't think she'd be a very big draw to help the ticket win. So that kind of baffles me.
Yeah. A number of these candidates, often vice presidential candidates aren't very well known in the country. I mean, who knew Mike Pence? How many Americans knew Tim Kaine, who people have forgotten was Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate? But, there was a certain logic to those picks, a certain political logic. I don't see any political logic to picking Susan Rice. She adds nothing to the ticket politically. And as you just pointed out, in terms of Biden's own, fields of specialization, she doesn't add anything, I think, substantively either. It's mm-hmm. It's just that, she signals that, you know, he's someone, she's someone he can work with. And it kind of also is a backward looking affirmation mm-hmm. of the Obama administration, which I don't think is a necessary virtue either at this juncture. I mean, Biden himself is that. So again, I really don't see what she adds to the ticket.
I agree with you on that. It's looking like it's probably going to be Kamala Harris, but who knows? I mean, anything could happen in the next week or two before Biden makes his selection. So,
well, I agree that Kamala is probably still to be favored. That, though, creates an interesting situation, because if that ticket wins, that creates a vacant Senate seat in California. And Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, gets to appoint a successor. And I think Karen Bass has inadvertently been positioned to be that successor. And I think she would be a great senator.
That's encouraging. Well, I'm sure if we can elect Biden, he'll put some of these wonderful vice presidential candidates in his administration somewhere. So the key is we got to get Trump out and get Biden in, and then we can sort out all the where all the chess pieces go.
Right, right.
So our last election was impacted negatively by voter suppression, and it did affect the outcome in some key races, like the governor race with Stacey Abrams running for governor in Georgia, and also Andrew Gilliam running for governor in Florida. It was pretty clear voter suppression made the both of them not win the governorships they should have won. How bad is voter suppression in this election, and what can we do to stop it?
Well, there's no question that their voter suppression is a key element of Republican strategy generally, and every effort will be made to do it. Now, I mean, I think Trumpization of the post office mm-hmm. is particularly maybe their lead form of voter suppression. But again, I think the key is in a state like Florida, and in Florida, of course, voters overwhelmingly passed an initiative allowing former felons to vote, and the Republicans in state government have been doing everything to keep that from happening, of questionable legality, but they have been doing that, almost reinstating a poll tax for former felons. So that's an issue in Florida, but I think the key is just to work to build such a large majority that even these efforts will not have the impact that they did in 2018. I think one of the tricky things is voter registration has become much more difficult in the absence of being able to personally contact people at their doorstep or at the supermarkets or what have you. But working the political universe every way progressives can, by social media, by phone, and where possible in person, I think the key is just building on Biden's lead in various states and making sure that that lead is enlarged, which would thwart the Republicans' voter suppression efforts.
Right. Good advice. And a number of Democrats have criticized Biden for being almost invisible. It's like after he won the primaries in the spring, he didn't quite disappear, but Trump is such a domineering force in the country and politics and the media, and you hardly ever seem to hear from Biden. Now, there is a line of thought that when the opponent is setting themselves afire in flames, don't get in the way, let them do it. So do you think this is a deliberate strategy, or do you think Biden should get out there and be more visible to the American people?
Well, I think the fact that he's just made a $280 million ad buy in 15 states suggests that he is going to be very visible. At this juncture, Trump's ongoing presence isn't helping Trump. I don't think it's a problem on a comparative basis. On sort of an absolute basis, should Biden be more visible? Yeah, he should. But, if I was running the Trump campaign, I would try to keep my guy under wraps, which is impossible. I mean, the real problem for the Republicans is Trump's visibility, and even worse, his audibility. If he just shut up, he'd probably, you know, gain a couple points in the polls.
Right. Great. Well, we're at our time. That's all the time we have right now. But if people want to learn more about you and your writing, they should go to prospect.org. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Excellent journalism. Excellent writing. Thank
you. Not just me, but our whole staff. We have a great piece online today on Cori Bush's victory in Missouri by one of our Wunderkinder, Alex Salmon. So www.prospect.org.
Great. I encourage our listeners to go to that website. Thank you so much for being with us today. And thanks again for your wonderful analysis. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eleanor. You take care.
Stay tuned for our next guest.
One of the great challenges of our time is the inequality in both income and wealth. The wealth